Well, if you'll turn to Psalm 37, really glad to be back with you. Missed you last Sunday. Loved Ben's message. We're going to pick back up in our series. It is impossible to interact with our culture today in a meaningful way without difficult questions being raised. You know, unless we try to blow a Christian bubble around ourselves, and even then we're still going to be encountering questions we may not have an immediate answer for. But if we're interacting with our culture in a meaningful way and even honest about our own uncertainties, we will encounter questions that for which we do not have an immediate answer. So let me give you a little bit of background as far as where this need to learn how to pause doubt became real in my life. As many of you know, growing up, I grew up in a non-Christian context, very skeptical church context where we didn't believe the Bible was the Word of God, didn't believe Jesus died or rose. We didn't believe any of the truths of the gospel. So the entire environment was extremely skeptical. And the community I grew up in like prided itself in things like education and human enlightenment. And so that's the context. And then hearing the gospel up in Canada, becoming a believer as a teenager, and then coming back, and I was so excited about what God had done in my life, I wanted to tell everybody. And I just assumed that they would be excited as well. So I began to go from house to house in my neighborhood, a very affluent, you know, highly educated neighborhood. And I just remember many of these people looking at me like this ignorant teenager. And several of them even said, come back and talk with me after you get out of college. Implying, you are a fool, and if you go to school or read anything, you will be educated out of your ignorance to believe what you believe. So then add that context to just a heart, that mind that naturally asks questions, wants to know why, and then reading widely skeptics, critics of the Bible in graduate school, and I love to read atheists, agnostics, traveling, interacting with people in other religions. So, you know, those kinds of questions that are going to emerge when you're interacting with people who do not believe like you are endless. And so, what do you do with these questions when they pop into your mind? And this is where, and I want to take you back about 20, 25 years ago, the concept of pausing doubt became real. William Lane Craig was a man who helped me a lot with this. Some of you may be familiar with him. He may be new to some of you. He actually, all of his life, has struggled with CMT syndrome, a neuromuscular disease that causes atrophy to the extremities. It's a disorder that affects the peripheral nervous system. So he limps slightly. His hands at times tighten as if he's gripping something. And in high school, he was not able to play sports, so he began to debate. And he became a proficient debater in high school, but he had a classmate who was a Christian. He did not grow up in a Christian home. And he became a believer in high school, went on to study philosophy in college, went on to earn two PhDs, one from Birmingham, England, Birmingham University in England, one from a university in Munich. And even still today, he debates all around the world. He will interact very freely in mathematics, cosmology, astrophysics, philosophy, in debates with the world's greatest atheists and agnostics. And for example, Richard Dawkins, the Oxford atheist, was quoted recently in the Chronicle of Higher Education. Dr. Craig is, quote, the one Christian apologist who seems to have put the fear of God into many of my fellow atheists. In the early 90s, I attended some of his debates. He debated an atheist down at USC, and I remember enjoying that debate, read many of his books. But there was one book that was not like his other books, which were more technical, but it was actually a compilation of sermons that he had preached in a church in the Midwest and had been turned into a book called No Easy Answers. And he had a chapter in that book on doubt. And I remember even today, several decades later, reading that chapter and being impacted by that chapter. And I want to share one quotation from that chapter. He said this, any thinking Christian will have a question bag filled with unresolved difficulties that he must learn to live with. But from time to time, as you have opportunity, it's good to take the bag down from the shelf, select one of the questions, and go to work on answering. I'll let you think about what he's saying there, because there are several huge implications in that statement. One is that facing difficult questions is not unusual for Christians. I probably shouldn't need to say that, but there are many of you sitting out there who think you are weird because your mind generates lots of questions. And you're probably sitting down the row from many others who feel the same way. Now, that doesn't mean you're not weird. It just may mean you're not weird for asking questions. Another implication, this is the big one for me at that time, is I don't need to ignore or succumb to difficult questions. And I want to look at both those ideas for a moment. And we're just still setting up the idea of why pause doubt. I don't need to ignore or succumb to difficult questions. By ignore, I'm referring to the fact that I don't, as a Christian, I don't need to be an obscurantist. Now, Alan was probably the only one that knows the meaning of that word. No, but if your first thought was, I don't know the meaning of that word and I don't want to, you're probably one. Obscurantism is basically an evasion of the facts, an evasion of clarity, an intentional ambiguity or sweeping facts under the rug. It's purposely concealing details. You see it every day in different forms. For example, in politics, it might look like a random politician who might hide official emails on personal servers. That is a form of obscurantism, a purposeful concealing of the facts. As churches, we're really good at obscurantism. And when we don't want to face difficult subjects or talk about things we might not have a quick answer to, or present an image of ourselves that isn't really the whole picture, the Sunday go-to-meeting, good-looking side of ourselves. In a sense, we are personally practicing obscurantism. There is a good side to obscurantism, like when your four-year-old says, Mommy, you know, how are babies made? You're probably going to be a tad obscurantist. Like, you may not give all the details at that moment. So it's not always wrong, but obscurantism is typically negative in the sense that we really don't want to wrestle with anything difficult, and don't confuse me with anything I don't agree with. I'd prefer to just go on living in my bubble of ignorance. So when we talk about pausing doubt, we are not talking about that. We're not saying, well, just put a pause on any difficult question and ignore it. As Christians, sometimes we're painted with that brush, aren't we? Like, just you have faith. I have reason. As if faith means you don't think. That's not what we're talking about, okay? And Dr. Craig's question bag example is not that. He is facing more difficult questions in a week than many of us will face in a lifetime. So he's not commending that. But he also is not commending succumbing to difficult questions in the sense that, you know, that feeling of intellectual pressure, or maybe even sometimes it's an emotional feeling of feeling frantic that I can't worship. I can't be happy. I can't even make breakfast until I get an answer to that question. You know, when questions flood over our minds, and many of us have been here on different levels of questions, it may not be an intellectual question, it could be more of an emotional struggle, but in some form we're facing a struggle that we feel like has to be resolved now. And for those of us who do not know how to pause doubt, it will mean our Christian life is constantly this. Like, constantly we are being swept away with the latest question or concern that we don't feel we have an answer for. And we become like mobile homes in a floodplain that don't have any mooring or foundation. So a simple definition of pausing doubt might be putting doubt in timeout. Putting doubt in timeout. It is refusing to allow an immediate question to define or dominate you. It is sewing a question bag, or if you're over 60, a fanny pack. It's creating an area, or maybe even some kind of like what Dr. Craig describes as a metaphorical, you know, place, question bag, where you can place questions that arise in normal life or in specific discussions that you might not have an answer for and you don't want to be paralyzed by, but you're not going to ignore, you hope to come back to soon. Does that make sense? That's what we want to learn how to do. How do you put doubt in timeout? And we're gonna see an illustration of this in Psalm 37. In Psalm 37, David is questioning God's justice. God's response to right and wrong seems passive at best, perverted at worst. The wrong people seem to be flourishing. And this is, his struggle is similar to Habakkuk's struggle last week. It's just he's going to respond, whereas, as Ben communicated last week, Habakkuk's is very biographical. It's very personal, this struggle he's having with God. This is King David's struggle and response in Psalm 37. He does biographically respond in other places, personally respond in other places. But here, Psalm 37 is more of a wisdom psalm. It's like putting Proverbs and Psalms in a blender. It's like putting wisdom to song. That's how he responds. And you're going to see that right from the beginning. Look at verse 1. Fret not. Fret not. So he's not telling his own personal journey. He's immediately offering us wisdom. And he continues to do that with that, fret not yourselves because of evildoers. Be not envious of wrongdoers. Look down to verse 7. Be still before the Lord and wait patiently for him. Fret not yourself over the one who prospers in his way. Verse 8, second half. Fret not yourself. It tends only to evil. So what is this word fret? In Hebrew, it's kara, which means to burn. And it can mean burn as in to be grieved or troubled. In this context, it means to inflame oneself with worry, envy, or impatience. It is a kind of heartburn that comes when we see people who follow God suffer and people who reject God or live hypocritically flourish. It is a form of doubt that flows from and feeds on envy, worry, impatience, and often leads to anger. Our hearts become inflamed with questions like, why do the wrong people win? Why do hypocrites succeed? Why does it seem like faithfulness is valued in theory, but irrelevant in practice? And the biggest one is, why doesn't God do something? And these questions are not theoretical. They carry an emotional fire with them. They can rise up at the most unpredictable times. For example, you might be earnestly praying for a loved one to survive and then get bad news about their physical condition, while at the very same time you hear about someone who rejects God experiencing what seems to be a miraculous healing. It's like, what is this, God? What are you doing? Or you're reading a book and a statement is made that looks at life or a particular situation from a perspective you've never thought about before, and it opens up a door of questions, and it's not just one question that comes, but that question leads to another question, which leads to another question. Before you know it, you're questioning everything. Like, if this is true, then everything I believe is fake. Or you're talking with a coworker, and something they say may seem insignificant. Like, it could be just they're talking about what a wonderful weekend they had, and you're thinking to yourself, well, wait a second, like, they don't even know God. They don't care about you, God. And their life just seems to be so good and happy, and they're moral, and they're nice, and they're nicer than a lot of Christians I know. So what is going on here? These are the kind of questions David is wrestling with. And these are the kind of questions that can not just come in like solitary form, but they come in waves. And they can be paralyzing. And they create a form of fretting that David is addressing in Psalm 37. So let's illustrate how to pause doubt in the face of these kinds of questions. And for the sake of time, we're not going to unpack the whole chapter. It's a big chapter. But David basically does three things in this chapter. Three things all sprinkled throughout the whole chapter. And we're going to summarize what those three things are that illustrate how to pause doubt. Number one, slow down. Slow down. This is what David says as he's calling us not to fret. Notice the timing statements. The timing statements. Verse 2, for they will soon fade. Verse 6, he will bring forth your righteousness as the light and your justice as the noonday. Verse 7, be still before the Lord and wait patiently for him. Verse 9, for the evildoers shall be cut off, but those who wait for the Lord shall inherit the land. Verse 10, in just a little while. Verse 11, but the meek shall inherit the land. By the way, this is the chapter that Jesus quotes from when he says in Matthew 5:5, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Verse 20, the wicked are compared to smoke that vanishes away. Verse 34, wait for the Lord. Verse 37, second half, for there is a future for the man of peace. But transgressors shall be altogether destroyed. The future of the wicked shall be cut off. Do you see all those? Those are just a few examples of the timing that David is addressing. And this is really important when it comes to pausing doubt. I had a friend named Mark who worked his way through college by painting. He was a really good painter, a really hard worker. He graduated from college debt-free simply because he worked constantly and painted every chance he got. And years later, he told me about a job he had in a church where he was hired to paint a baptistry. And he thought, this will take no time. Got that heavy-duty waterproof epoxy kind of paint. And he's in this baptistry, and it's a really deep baptistry. And he was painting away, cutting in, rolling this intense paint, and not wearing any kind of mask. And he began to feel like this is taking forever. So he painted faster and faster and faster. And eventually, and he's a very skilled painter, but he painted himself into a corner. Like he's painting and he's running out of room, so he just steps on the paint he just painted, paints the rest of it, and then drops everything and runs down the aisle of the church, footprints all the way down, runs outside and looks at his watch and thinks he had been painting for at least 8 to 10 hours. And it was about 15 minutes. Like obviously, the fumes disoriented him. Killed a few brain cells. Fortunately, he has lots to spare. But I think what happened to Mark in the baptistry, and he had to go back and clean all the footprints and then clean up his job in there. But what happened to him in the baptistry is what often happens to us in a context where doubt floods over us. It disorients us. The fumes of doubt disorient us. We lose track of time and we feel that frantic sense that I got to do something right now. And that's what David was talking about with this idea of fretting. That feeling, frantic feeling. And what he's saying with these timing statements is slow down. Wait patiently. When we slow down, what we are doing is acknowledging that the way things appear and feel can be delusionally, as Ben said last week, myopic. Like we begin to only see the things right in front of us and we can't see the future clearly. And then we begin to predict the future based on our limited view of the present. Like because things are this way right now and because I don't have all the answers at this moment, then therefore everything I believe in is fake. Or the future is hopeless. Wait. Wait for the Lord. And what we're doing when we slow down, and this is at the core of pausing doubt, is we are acknowledging that our brains are limited. We are acknowledging that our doubts are dated. Do you understand what I mean by that? Dr. Craig talks about visiting with Frederick Copplestone, one of the greatest historians of philosophy, written massive volumes of the history of philosophy. He was meeting with him in England one time, and he said, what's the greatest thing you've learned through your long career of studying philosophy? And he basically said, the biggest thing I've learned is how tightly linked our philosophies are to our own culture and context. Our doubts are the same way. They are extremely dated. They will come into fashion and go out of fashion quite quickly. So if you evaluate the question you're currently wrestling with only in the context that you're currently in, you're going to feel that baptistry feeling. The fumes of that question can disorient you. You lose a sense of timing. You feel frantic, and you end up coming to conclusions that are not consistent with reality. They may be consistent with your little box that you're living in at that moment, or the culture that you're bound to. Wait. So what are some practical ways we can slow down thoughts? And by wait, I don't mean necessarily physically. We're not talking about just sitting in a lazy boy chair. What he's talking about is slow those racing thoughts down. And what are some practical ways? Ironically, one of the ways that I find most helpful is to go for a walk or a run or like a just to get out in the open air, kind of like Mark getting out of the baptistry, where you're trying to get your thoughts together and you're actually then communicating your questions to God. And there's something about articulating those or writing them out in a prayer journal or speaking. There's another one, speaking with a friend or a counselor about this question. Just verbalizing this. Alan wrote a really good blog this week for parents on the Doubt blog. Parents and walking through doubt with your kids. Just that verbalizing of those doubts can be extremely helpful in slowing them down and acknowledging how time-bound they are. Worshiping in song. Even memorizing scripture is a way of slowing down, because we're not just moving on to the next thing. We're coming back over and over again, praying through scripture. Great athletes have a capacity to do this. You will notice that. The quarterback who's in the pocket when the defensive line is charging can quickly get frantic and hurl the ball just to get rid of it, right? And what will he do, generally speaking? He will consistently throw interceptions. Like, the great quarterback has to, even under great pressure, like it looks like you're about to be crushed, slow their thoughts down to think clearly, to find a target. The great basketball player who, when the crowd is screaming and the fans are doing all sorts of things to speed their thoughts up and confuse their mind, steps up to the foul line, has to slow his thoughts or her thoughts down and just place the ball where it needs to go. The greatest strikers have an ability that, according to the British, to compose themselves. Now, that may seem weird when you're running very fast. So physically, you're exerting yourself at intense speed. Defenders are crushing around you. A goalie is coming out at you. But the great strikers have an ability in that moment to slow their thoughts down, look where they want the ball to go, look down at the ball, and just put it where they want it to go. That's what we're doing when we're pausing doubt. Number one, slow down. Number two, look up. Look up. You'll notice the second thing that David does is he quickly turns our attention away from the source of fretting. Verse 3, trust in the Lord. Verse 4, delight yourself in the Lord. Verse 5, commit your way to the Lord. Now, this may feel a little awkward at this moment, because when we look up in the midst of a flood of questions, we are acknowledging that our feelings about God may not be completely accurate. Because some of you may be saying, hey, when I get flooded with questions, the last person I want to go to is God, because I'm doubting him. You're not supposed to go to the one you're doubting. But David says, no, when you slow your thoughts down and you look to God, what you're acknowledging is that my momentary assessment of your goodness and greatness may not be entirely accurate. As a matter of fact, David, throughout the chapter, gives us example after example of the way God is really thinking and what he's really doing in contrast to what we feel he is doing and thinking in the midst of our fretting. Let me give you a few examples. Verse 13, the Lord laughs. The Lord laughs. It's like a scrawny little 10-year-old going up to LeBron James saying, I'm going to dunk in your face. Cute kid. So David says in verse 13 that in the midst of this flood of questions, when everybody's frantic and God is supposedly disposable, God may snicker. Verse 17, the Lord upholds the righteous. And this is a great one because when I read that, I think, well, exactly, that's the problem. I'm not righteous, and he upholds the righteous. But where does that turn my attention? To Christ, who is my righteousness. If I am coming to God in and of myself, then I will be not upheld, because I will be coming in my own righteousness, but he is my righteousness. His sinless life is on my account. His death was in my place, and therefore I can grab a promise like that and say, you uphold the righteous, and in and of myself, I do not fit that category, but in Christ, I am upheld. What you're doing is you're realigning your thinking from the way you feel or what you deserve to what God really is doing and thinking. Verse 18, the Lord knows. He knows our days from eternity past to eternity future. We don't. He does. Verse 28, the Lord loves justice. He will not forsake his saints. And it sure feels like he does forsake, but pausing doubt, you're looking up, you're stepping out of the fumes of the baptistry. Verse 33, the Lord will not abandon or let us be condemned. He will not abandon. And then like a climax at the end of an opera where every voice is united with every instrument, you see in verse 40 this flood of the Lord helps them, the Lord delivers, the Lord saves, because they take refuge in him. So when we look up to God, and those are just a few examples, there are many more in the chapter. When we look up, we are not ignoring hard questions. We are turning on our GPS to look up and locate ourselves more accurately. And then finally, David says, live out. Live out. Look at verse 3. Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and befriend faithfulness. Trust in the Lord. That's the looking up. But then immediately he goes to, now live that out. Do good. Dwell in the land. He's taking us back to that theme we saw so much in Genesis. Dwell in the land that, yes, is the land of promise, but yes, is filled with enemies who want to hurt us. But in that place, befriend faithfulness. Befriend faithfulness. Tend to faithfulness. Pursue faithfulness. Doubt tends to heat and cool us. It heats us up by aggravating us. It cools us down by freezing or paralyzing us. An antidote to this kind of paralysis is what Psalm 37 describes as living out wisdom. And notice how intensely practical this is. Verse 21, the wicked borrows but does not pay back, but the righteous is generous and gives. Generosity matters. Verse 27, turn away from evil and do good, so shall you dwell forever. What does he mean, do good? Well, the very thing that everyone around you in the context of Psalm 37 is not doing, do that. This is a word from God for us to reject the moral pragmatism of the context that we are living in. When you watch your coworkers rise the ladder based on deception and flattery, it's really easy to want to do the same thing when in Rome. What David is saying, part of pausing doubt, slow down, look up, and now live out in very practical ways who you are in him. Another example. Verse 30. The mouth of the righteous utters wisdom, and his tongue speaks justice. So when it feels like everyone is defaulting on loans, cheating on tests, speaking rubbish online or in person, God is telling us to be generous with our money, kind with our deeds, and wise with our words. And you say, why is this so important in regards to pausing doubt? When doubt heats us up, aggravates us, and then cools us down in a sense of paralyzing us, what it does is it tends to minimize the significance of little things. In light of the questions that are flooding your mind, you feel like the little things don't matter. What does it matter if I clean the dishes or not? What does it matter if I look at porn or not? What does it matter if I pay my bills or not? What does it matter if I speak kindly to the lady at the cash register or not? Like, what does that matter? Do you realize the kind of questions I'm wrestling with in my head? You know that feeling. Like when you feel frantic and confused and uncertain, the little things of life suddenly seem so insignificant. These big questions just can be overwhelming and crushing. And David in this context is saying, slow down, look up, and then in light of that, live out. Like, what's the next faithful little thing God is calling you to do? It may be to help someone financially. It may be to pay a bill. It may be to speak a word of wisdom in the context of utter confusion. When we don't know how to pause doubt, skepticism becomes big and faithfulness becomes irrelevant. When we pause doubt, we are acknowledging three things based on these three things David has said. Number one, this question is not eternal. Like, I'm going to know the answer, even if it's not in this life. I'm going to know. Secondly, this question is not absolute. God is. God does not fluctuate with our uncertainties. As 2 Timothy 2:13 says, if we are faithless, he is still faithful. Our doubt does not change who he is. And thirdly, this question is not ethically defining. It doesn't negate the faithfulness in the little things. That things really matter, and it's this is, can you see the importance of this, not just for us personally and our individual lives, but for living out the gospel at this time in this world where faithfulness in the little things seems not to matter? Pausing doubt has huge implications on the way we live and who we are as followers of Jesus. Daniel Taylor summarizes it well. I have learned to live with the rise and fall of the thoughts and feelings of faith, to coexist with honest doubt, to accept tension and paradox without clinging to it as an excuse for inaction. And today it's very easy to look around and the biggest thing I remember from the debate of Dr. Craig at USC was how his opponent was so good at raising questions but not answering any. And that's the culture we live in, where it's really cool to ask questions and but not want answers. And so in that context, we can be flooded with questions and feel very uncertain. And we need to know how to pause doubt.